Words of hate are unwelcome in Pittsburgh. It starts with everyone in this room. And I want to address for a moment some of our political leaders who are here. Ladies and gentlemen, it has to start with you as our leaders.
One day after a man stormed into the Tree of Life synagogue, killing 11 worshipers and injuring six, Pittsburgh Rabbi Jeffrey Myers addressed a crowd of mourners. Before the attack, the gunman, armed with an AR-15 assault rifle, had posted anti-Semitic messages on social media. It has been called the deadliest attack on the Jewish community in U.S. history. And it's not the only place of worship that has experienced such horror.
It seems to break all the rules that you've come to establish. That's not supposed to happen in a synagogue. It's not supposed to happen in a church. It's not supposed to happen in a temple. These are sacred places, sanctuaries.
Over the past few years, there have been a number of deadly shootings at places of worship across the country, some motivated by race or religion, some not. In 2012, six people were killed in a shooting at a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. A white supremacist shot and killed nine people in a historically black church in Charleston, South Carolina in 2015. And nearly 1 year ago, 26 people were killed in a church in the tiny town of Sutherland Springs, Texas. But temples, mosques, churches, and synagogues are supposed to be, quite literally, sacred spaces, safe places, where worshipers are surrounded by family and community members and where they can be at their most vulnerable. So when that feeling of safety is ripped away, what comes next? The search for a path forward for religious communities after an attack. This is The Takeaway. I have three guests here with me, each one who has experienced an attack at a religious center. Joining us from Kansas is Mindy Corcoran, the president and co-founder of the Faith Always Wins Foundation. In 2014, Mindy lost both her father and her 14-year-old son when a neo-Nazi fired on the Jewish Community Center of Greater Kansas City in Overland Park, Kansas. Pradeep Kalika joins us from Washington, D.C. He's the author of The Gift in Our Wounds and is the eldest son of Satwan Singh Kalika, the president of the Sikh temple in Wisconsin, who was shot dead in 2012 when a gunman attacked the temple. And Deacon Kevin McCormick joins us as well. He's the principal of Zavarian High School in Brooklyn and Roman Catholic deacon for the Diocese of Rockville Center, assigned to Our Lady of Peace Parish in Lynbrook, New York. In 2002, a gunman shot a priest and a woman in the parish where he is currently assigned in Long Island. Mindy, Pradeep, and Kevin, thank you all for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us on.
Thank you very much.
I want to start going around hearing how each of you is responding to the shooting on Saturday. Mindy, what are your thoughts there?
My response initially was to write a letter to the Tree of Life Synagogue as a grieving mother and daughter, still 4 years from the shooting. I woke up the next morning with a letter being written in my head, and I sent them a letter giving them some instructions, giving them some direction and some peace and hope and love, hoping that that will help them very quickly. I received thousands of letters after the death that we experienced, and I like to pay it forward. And then last night, I attended a vigil in Kansas City, in the Kansas City area, and it was held at a synagogue, and there were about 3,000 people present offering prayer for everyone in Pittsburgh and for the Jewish faith.
Pradeep, your reaction to the Saturday shootings?
I just heavy heart, and it feels like every time one of these, and I hate to say one of these because it feels like it's happening a much more frequent clip, but when one of these happens, I allow myself a little bit of time to just kind of step back, gather, and just take a breath and really just then move forward. I'm out in D.C. I'm just continuing to work on what we've been working on for the past 6 years, and which is responding to hate crime within the United States, preventing that from happening, and just continue on with the work that we've been doing.
And Kevin, your reaction?
It kind of returns to the roots. You're belonging to a Christian community, Catholic community. The death and resurrection is all part of what we do. And we spend a lot of time often on the good stuff, and we have to remind ourselves that it's in the pain that our faith is truly tested. And it's been a very difficult time for everyone, and it kind of reminds us of the real human experience.
And Kevin, in 2002, a gunman shot a priest and a woman in the parish where you are currently working in Long Island. Tell us about the shock and reaction that faith leaders have when these types of events happen.
It's sort of like it's not true. It's as if this is a nightmare or a dream that you can't wait to wake up from. And then slowly it seeps in, or maybe not so slowly, that the reality is blatant right in front of you. And it seems to break all the rules that you've come to establish. That's not supposed to happen in a synagogue. It's not supposed to happen in a church. It's not supposed to happen in a temple. These are sacred places, sanctuaries. And it sort of like shakes the reality in which you kind of base your whole life in.
I'm curious, Mindy, you lost both your father and your 14-year-old son after a hate crime, a neo-Nazi fired on the Jewish Community Center at Greater Kansas City in Overland Park. When you see this type of violence happening in a place of worship, how do you process that?
I cry. I initially cry. I pray. I pray for God to take everyone to heaven. I pray for the families, and I pray for all the changes that their lives are going to feel going forward. But I initially cry, and I journal. I do a lot of writing.
And Pradeep, your father, as we mentioned, was killed when a gunman attacked the Sikh temple of Wisconsin in 2012. How do you process something like this happening in a place of worship, in a place that's supposed to be sacred?
You try to return that level of sanctuary back to that place, and try not to let the action define your community and define what you're about. I think that's what, you know, when we talk about this, we talk about it within the context of healing, and definitely you have to heal yourself, but there's a level of communal healing that needs to happen as well. When this happened in 2012, we saw faiths of all different communities come together and heal together, and that's going to be what's going to happen going forward.
You know, there was a young lady who was quoted in a news report after the shooting at the synagogue who said she was responding to the thoughts and prayers that are often told after a tragedy like this, and she basically, and I'm paraphrasing here, said, "The place where I go to pray isn't safe anymore." Mindy, when the place that God is supposed to be present in is a place for violence, how do you hold on to your faith in that moment?
Well, God is everywhere. God isn't just in that place. That when a building is built and people are there, they're really there for community. And they may be thinking that that's the only place that they can find God, but they're mistaken. They need to understand. Everyone should understand that God's everywhere.
And Mindy, I'm curious, for those who have lost friends or family members, do you have any advice for them in dealing with what they're dealing with in these upcoming days? I know some of the funerals are starting to begin, if I'm not mistaken, today, and I mentioned the president going down to Pittsburgh.
Yes, it's his responsibility. It's the president's responsibility to be there, and it's the president's responsibility in all years to help people grieve. What I would say to the family members and the people in the community is similar to what I wrote in the letter, is right now you're in a fog. Right now the pain you think that is deep and hurting is going to get deeper. It is a significant sorrow. Your lives are changed forever. And I don't sugarcoat it when I talk to people who lose family members from anything, that it doesn't just take time. It takes effort to push through the grief. From my faith, I pray more. From my faith, I read more scripture. I commune with people who bring me joy. If I have people in my life who don't bring me joy or cause me anxiety or stress, I eliminate them from my life. So you change your perspective on life significantly when something like this happens. So what I would say to them is immediately just let things take place and happen. But in the coming months and a few years, that's when you will see that you're going to be called. Perhaps God will call you to do something and have an action and make something good come from this. And I want those people to listen. That's what we've done. That's what our family has done by creating the foundation we created.
And Pradeep, your advice for families who are dealing with this week and beyond?
Just take refuge into yourselves, your families, your community, the broader community. It's almost a fake it till you make it type of thing, where you're going through the protocol of grieving. You're going through, making arrangements for the details of burial. There's so many logistics that have to happen. What's going to happen is over time, that's going to go away, and sort of the adrenaline of what is happening now, and then the limelight of being in front of cameras and putting on the brave face will leave. And that's when, like Mindy said, like they're going to have to decide, like, who are they? And that question will keep coming up. And it'll ask you to have that inner voice of, no, you're not just a person. You're not a set of characters and a name. You're not your occupation. You're not some label. Who are you inside? And they will have discovered that they were more than they ever thought they were.
Kevin, I want to ask you, I haven't obviously experienced this, but I can imagine that must be a very difficult thing. How give us some tips on how to even process those emotions.
I don't know if I have tips, but I initially have a betrayal of assumptions, and that's where my anger came from. I assumed that a shul would be a place of peace, and it clearly wasn't. Then I have to go back to my roots and say, what is my religion say? What does my tradition say? And I have to go back and realize that this prosperity gospel that's very popular in our country right now, that seems to be what Christianity's cloaked itself in, is a fraud and a lie. Our God is a God who's in the midst of suffering. Our God is on a cross for the Christians. And that has to be reminded that that's the root. It's in the suffering of human experience that we are most vulnerable, that we are most open, and we are most able to really touch what God is about. The minute vengeance replaces forgiveness, we put a wall up. And Pradeep said it perfectly, and Mindy's heart is clear in everything she's saying, the same thing, that we become as monstrous as the shooter if we demand that retribution. It's very difficult, and I have no tips because I struggle with it, but ultimately I have to learn to forgive his actions, to forgive him, if I have any hope to grow.
You know, one more thing I want to add is that the president suggested that this would not have happened had there been armed guards there. I have to ask, Kevin, your response to that?
I find it disgusting and painful even to think of that in the United States of America, the supposed leader of the free world, we need to guard people in houses of worship. It's something out of some horror show. I got to be honest, I can't wrap my head around that at all.
And Pradeep.
I agree with Kevin. I think it's cowardice. The president of the United States right now, and I'm not a liberal or Democrat, I'm pretty moderate, but right now the president of the United States not only has blood at his doorstep, he has blood on his hands. So people are wise to say, you know what, we don't want you here because you're adding to this fuel.
Mindy, your thoughts?
My thoughts on that topic are that let's start before we even discuss armed guards. There were posts on an internet site, a hate site that is supposed to be being watched. And why is that not being watched? Why are people who seemingly should be on a watch list not being taken care of? The shooter in our instance posted several years before he obtained guns, which he wasn't supposed to have. He obtained everything that he needed under no watchful eye, and he should have been watched. He posted on the internet that he wanted to kill Jews, and nothing was done about it. And then in this instance, this shooter did the same thing. And, you know, why aren't we starting there? We should have the opportunity to go into a place of worship and pray whenever we want to, while other people are espousing hate. They are the ones who need to be watched, not us.
Mindy Corporon is the president of the Faith Always Wins Foundation. Pradeep Kalika is the author of The Gift of Our Wounds. And Deacon Kevin McCormick is the principal of Xaverian High School and a Roman Catholic deacon in Long Island. Mindy, Pradeep, and Kevin, thank you all for sharing your experiences and your thoughts.
What an honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us on.
Thank you very much.
In 2004, Hurricane Ivan bowled over an oil rig belonging to Taylor Energy, setting off a massive oil spill on the coast of Louisiana that's been growing steadily for 14 years. Every day, the site has been spewing between 300 to 700 barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. Taylor Energy has cleaned up some of the mess, but they've also been suing the government to avoid a full cleanup of the site. And if the spill is not stopped soon, it's on track to become one of the worst in U.S. history. Michael Kunzelman is a reporter with the Associated Press, and he's been reporting on the Taylor oil spill for years. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So this spill started in 2004, and it's now back in the news because the Justice Department had an independent analysis about this. Tell us about that. What did they find?
Well, they found that the leak appears to be much worse than either the company or the government itself has been saying for many years. The latest estimates, which were put together by an independent researcher from Florida, found that between 10,000 to 30,000 gallons of oil is leaking daily from multiple wells around that platform that toppled over during Hurricane Ivan in 2004. And the reason why this is an issue now, after all these many years, is that Taylor Energy, a company based in New Orleans that doesn't have any assets anymore, it essentially only exists to fight this spill, is trying to recover hundreds of millions of dollars that it set aside years ago to try to end this leak. They want the money back. The government says, no, you need to do more to finish what you started here down below the surface of the Gulf.
Obviously, there's a money issue here, but what is it about this spill? Why has it taken so long for this to stop? This looks like it's an environmental disaster that's been going on in our own backyard.
Well, it hadn't gotten a lot of attention until recently. That's true. The company's position is that basically, look, this is not any different than the natural seeps that occur out there out in the Gulf of Mexico that are harmless. That's their position.
Are they right about that, though?
Well, I mean, I think that's open to debate, certainly. And the government's position is very different, that does pose a potential threat to the environment and that they have to go out there and do what they can. The problem is that when that hurricane rolled through and knocked over the drilling platform, it also buried the underground wells under mountains of sediment that they cannot go and simply dredge without risking somebody's life. That's the company, what the company says. Now, the company did kill some of the wells, they said, but they said that nothing more can be done without causing potentially greater risk. If they go in there and they take the sediment away, it could make the leak even worse, possibly. So there's very little disagreement, it seems like, between the government and the company about what needs to be done next. But the government believes that something can be done, and they, I believe, are going to order the company to do something else down there below the surface.
I'm just wondering, the Taylor oil spill is back in the news, but it's rivaling this BP oil spill in 2010. I can't forget the images of the BP oil spill. They were like on loop. And I'm wondering how this is affecting the environment differently than the BP oil spill did in 2010.
Well, in 2010, the BP oil spill, as we all remember, we were kind of transfixed by the images of this billowing wave of crude oil coming out of the bottom of the seafloor. It was coming out all at once, you know, over the period of, granted, I believe 3 months or so, but that massive amount of oil came out all at once, and that has, you know, it oiled birds on the seashore, and it created an environmental catastrophe. And in this case, this has been a slow motion environmental problem with Taylor Energy. It's seeped out slowly, and I'm not a scientist, but I've been told that the damage and the effect is far less serious when it's staggered out and the oil can be weathered by waves and water, and it doesn't have quite the same impact. Also, the company has said that there's no evidence that this oil from the Taylor Energy leak is reaching shore. It's about 12 miles off the coast of Louisiana, and these slicks stretch for miles every day, or almost every day.
But don't those slicks also have an impact on the environment, whether we can see them or not? I mean, who's supposed to make sure that this is an environmentally sound place?
Again, I believe that there is some disagreement about this between the two sides. The company has its own experts who say that there is no environmental ecological risk or danger or damage. And then the government says differently, that there's at least the potential for damage to the ecology out there, even if it's not oiling birds on the shore. You know, there's fish, there's other marine life out there that could be affected by these persistent and chronic leaks.
So we know that Taylor Energy is suing the federal government. What else are they doing? We understand that one of the former owner's widow is a prominent philanthropist in Louisiana.
Yeah, so the Taylor name is best known probably in Louisiana for a program called TOPS. It's the T in TOPS, which has financed free college tuition for many families over the years. This is a couple didn't have kids of their own. They invested a lot of money in helping other people, millions of dollars in philanthropy work. Mrs. Taylor, his widow, is also a very influential political figure, donor to many congressmen and senators. And she had hired lawyers to lobby on Capitol Hill to try to get the company a break. So it's still a fight that's ongoing, both in court and also separately. The company had tried to petition a somewhat obscure government agency to give it a relief from this longstanding order that it had to do more down below the seafloor in terms of drilling intervention wells to try to kill underground wells. So there's two fronts, but primarily this has become a case about money and about how much more they need to spend or have available to spend down below the surface.
Michael Kunzelman is a reporter with the Associated Press. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We reached out to a few scientists working around the Gulf about the Taylor oil spill. Vernon Asper, a marine geologist at the University of Southern Missouri, told us that he thinks Taylor Energy should not have to clean up the site, but instead they should fund scientific research to study the leaks. There are about 20 oil blowouts in federal and state waters every year. Professor Asper says scientists could use the Taylor oil spill to examine the impact of the oil, how the seafloor community responds to it, how it interacts with plankton, and how oil is transported from the surface to the seafloor. Professor Asper also said some scientists have requested intentional releases of oil, basically creating a spill in the Gulf to study these effects, but the Taylor site could be a good compromise. What do you think about solutions like this? Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, B-A-B-B-L-E.com, or download the app to try it for free. Babbel.com.
If you live in Montana, a portion of your property tax every year goes to funding public colleges. And that's the only tax of its kind in the country. And every 10 years, Montanans get to vote on whether to continue this tax. For the last 80 years, they voted yes. But this November, it's not such a sure thing. In Montana and around the country, support of higher education is waning. Kirk Carapeza is with me, and he's the managing editor of our partner WGBH's Higher Education Desk, and he spent some time in Montana reporting this story out. Hi, Kirk.
Hey, Tanzina.
So, Kirk, how significant is this funding? How much money are we talking about? And how much of an impact would it have if Montanans vote not to extend this?
Right. So a bit of history. So since 1948, every 10 years, Montana voters have said yes to this statewide property tax. It provides basically what was described to me as base funding for public colleges. The tax adds $12 a year to a homeowner's property tax bill for every $100,000 worth of value. As you said, this is the only tax of its kind in the country, and it raises about $20 million annually. Now, that doesn't sound like very much, but $20 million is 10% of all state appropriations. And so that money helps subsidize the cost for families who can't afford it. It covers salaries and benefits for faculty and staff. And the tax will be on the ballot for the eighth time next week. And what we're hearing is that supporters of the tax are really concerned right now because we are seeing these negative attitudes toward higher ed.
Okay, so let's hear what some of the opponents are saying. Here are two voters that you spoke with.
Every time I see that on my property tax bill, I go, why am I doing that?
I've got friends and I've got acquaintances. Kids went to school, they paid money, and the kids are sitting and they're living in their basement. They're just not up to speed.
So is the issue here that it's just too expensive?
Right, so opponents of the tax who I spoke with in Montana describe it as kind of a relic of the past. They say taxpayers shouldn't continue to support a system that needs reform. They say higher ed is out of touch. It's a bastion of liberalism. I mean, I heard a number of concerns, mostly from older property owners in Montana. They think that the system is overeducating students so that they're leaving the state. And also enrollment is down or flat across the whole system. So a lot of voters are asking, why should we as taxpayers continue to fund public colleges if enrollment is dropping?
And you also spoke to Steve Bullock, who's the Democratic governor of the state of Montana. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
popular climate might be to say, oh, let's not be paying for the public goods that we need. I think fundamentally here in Montana, still the importance of higher education to our overall state is recognized.
Bullock is an interesting politician. He's a red state Democrat. You know, while Trump won by 20 percentage points, he won by just 4%. Bullock may not want to say this or see it this way, but this vote, I think, tells us something bigger and broader about how the public perceives colleges. And it seems like many of the voters I spoke with do not necessarily see higher ed as a public good, but as a private gain. You know, he may want to paint this as a Montana tradition, but they still have to go out there and really make the case for why taxpayers are continuing to fund it.
Is this a Montana-specific ideology that you're hearing, or is this something that's more broadly accepted across the United States? Just, I'm thinking about how in New York, for example, in New York State, we've had this big fight about making public universities more accessible.
Right. In blue states, we're having this debate about making higher education tuition-free or at least debt-free. But most of the economists I speak with say we're so far away from that, Tanzina, that first we just have to make it affordable. If you look at the Academy of Arts and Sciences and some of the studies they've done on state funding, since 2008, states have cut funding by about, on average, by about 30% per full-time student. And when states cut back, that shifts the cost to students and families. So if taxpayers aren't picking up the bill, someone else has to pay for it. So I think it's, you know, it's one thing for Bernie Sanders or other progressive politicians to tout free college. But when you look at the reality, our country is moving in the opposite direction.
Kirk Carapeza is managing editor of our partner WGBH's Higher Education Desk, and he reported this story in collaboration with the Hechinger Report. Kirk, thanks as always.
Thanks, Tanzina.
We go to Alaska now, and ballot measure number one, otherwise known as the Salmon Initiative. Next week, voters will decide whether to increase regulations to protect salmon habitats or keep the status quo. Elizabeth Harbaugh is a reporter with Alaska Public Media and Alaska's Energy Desk, and she joins me now from Anchorage. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what is ballot measure one?
In general, it's aimed at increasing, making stiffer the permitting requirements for projects, development projects in salmon habitat. It's quite complex.
Is this good for salmon or bad for salmon?
Good question. And even that is controversial. Everything about this initiative is controversial here in Alaska. But in general, it's aimed at setting up kind of a tiered permitting system. You would have minor permits for what the ballot proponents say are smaller projects. And then for bigger projects, your mines, your dams, your oil developments, those would have to go through a major permitting process. And the idea is that that would be a much stiffer permitting process with more opportunity for public comment.
Let's talk a little bit about who's on both sides. You spoke to Carly Weir, who works for an Alaskan environmental group. And what did she tell you?
So proponents of this initiative, one of their big arguments is that salmon is an incredibly precious resource to Alaskans. And Alaska is kind of one of the last places in the world where we have these really rich, wild salmon fisheries.
We've seen all over the rest of the world what happens when we don't protect onshore habitat where salmon spawn. They're gone. Alaska has salmon. This is actually the last stand for wild salmon on the planet here in Alaska.
But beyond that, for a lot of Alaskans, including Alaska Native people, they're relied on for subsistence. People rely on them for food, and they're also of huge cultural importance. So proponents say that this measure puts in place some needed protections to make sure that we preserve those fisheries.
But then there are folks on the other side. For example, you spoke to Joshua Kindred, who works for the Interior Department and used to represent the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, and he's not too sold on this.
The very premise that this initiative is about saving salmon and not about stopping development is flat out wrong. And so it's an emotional appeal to Alaskans because everybody in Alaska loves salmon, but this has nothing at all to do with salmon.
This ballot initiative has gotten a lot of pushback, actually that's putting it lightly, from the oil and gas industry, the mining industry, from unions, from Alaska Native corporations. Their big message is not that they are against salmon. Nobody in Alaska is against salmon or will say that they're against salmon and protecting salmon. Their argument is that this initiative goes way too far.
Too far in what, Elizabeth?
in the sense that because of this kind of toughened up permitting process, it would slow development. It could potentially prevent developments from happening. And then it could open the door to more litigation, which definitely could slow or potentially halt projects that are up against a lot of opposition.
How do ordinary Alaskans feel about the ballot measure?
I think ordinary Alaskans have a very complicated feeling about this ballot measure. Of course, you have some Alaskans who are very pro-industry, pro the mining industry, pro the oil industry. They're going to vote against it. Then you have Alaskans who want salmon prioritized above all else, and they're going to vote for it. And then I think most Alaskans are really grappling with this initiative. They're not sure if it goes too far, or they're not sure if what we have in place right now isn't doing enough to protect what we have. And because the initiative itself is so kind of complicated, there's a lot of confusion about what it will do. And, you know, I've talked to many Alaskans who I respect who are really, really grappling with this.
Is there one side that's more heavily funded than the other?
Absolutely. Stand for Alaska, Vote No on One, that is the industry-supported coalition, has raised well over $11 million, which is more than any of Alaska's gubernatorial candidates combined. The pro-ballot Measure One crowd has raised a little over $1 million, but because there's no public polling on this, there hasn't been yet, I really don't have a clear sense on whether all that money that the people who are against the initiative have raised, what impact that will have at the ballot box. It's hard to tell at this point.
Hmm. Elizabeth Harbaugh is a reporter with Alaska Public Media and Alaska's Energy Desk. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
I'm Tanzina Vega. Welcome back to The Takeaway. When mass killings like the one in Pittsburgh spark a national conversation, parents face the challenge of talking to their kids about difficult things like hate and senseless violence. And those of you with kids have been sharing your thoughts with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hi, this is Clary from Palmer. And we tell our kids that people that behave violently against peaceful people are pathetic. We talk to them about being vigilant about the people that surround you, to report suspicious behavior. We try not to be overly alarmist. We also tell them that most people are good and to focus on making positive relationships.
Hi, I'm calling from Kirkwood, Missouri. When things like this happen, my kids and I talk about the root causes of them, such as trauma that this person may have had in their past or social isolation they may be experiencing right now. So we just sort of talk about what's going on in people's lives that turn them so wrong.
This is Bashan Mann calling from Washington, D.C. I have two daughters, age 9 and 11. We don't shy away from conversations. We don't try to hide what's happening. So we just have a very open and honest dialogue.
And our next guest has been thinking a lot about this. Jennifer Rich is an assistant professor at Rowan University and the director of research and education at the Rowan Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies. And she's been talking with both her students in the classroom and to her kids at home. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you're the mother of two young Jewish boys. What was their reaction to the horror that we witnessed over the weekend?
They were scared. They took it really personally. They didn't know how to react. My younger son in particular said almost immediately, "What? You mean people want to kill me more just because I'm Jewish?" He asked if he needed to tell his public school teacher about this because in the event of a real lockdown at public school, would a bad guy come for his class first because he was Jewish? Would they know?
Do children process these types of events differently than adults do?
Yeah, in a word, yes, they do. Children, of course, depending on age, right? Children aren't able to understand that things like this are statistically rare. And while we're all scared as a country right now, children and adults alike are scared about what's going on. We're all having a really hard time processing this. Children, and the younger the child, the harder this is to understand, have no sense that this statistically probably won't happen to me. It feels very immediate. It feels very scary. And they don't have the tools to make sense of of what's gone on.
You mentioned, you said we're all scared, and I think I think that's true for a lot of people, and I'm assuming you mean just generally across the United States with what's happening today. As an adult, how much of that, of your own fear, should you show your children or not show your children? How honest should you be with your kids about your own concerns?
I think there's a fine line that we want to walk as parents, and I'm answering this as a parent first, not as a teacher. I think as a parent, we want our kids to understand that feeling scared, sad, confused is a really healthy and normal reaction, while walking that really fine line of it's okay to go to synagogue, it's okay to go to Hebrew school, it's okay to go to a grocery store and not worry about being killed, not worry about violence. And at the same time, this happened. Unfortunately, I don't believe that this violence is slowing down necessarily in today's political climate. I think the rhetoric, the polarization is really amped up. And so we want to let them know that they're safe, that they're in a community that protects them, that cares about them. And they should take comfort in that and understand there are also procedures in place to help keep them safe.
You talk about dropping off your kids at an emergency session of Hebrew school the day after the massacre. How helpful was that? And how helpful was the community response for your kids to understand what had happened?
It was helpful. It was particularly helpful for my older son, who is in middle school now and took comfort from the fact that he was with lots of other Jewish kids at the same time that he was processing this. They talked about the fact that they were a community, that they were safe, that they were instituting lockdown and evacuation procedures, both from the religious school classrooms and the synagogue building. And he came out and reported that that was helpful.
How do you tell children about something that's this random, right? It seems very pervasive, but it's also very random. It feels like, it, you mentioned, it could happen in a supermarket, it could happen in a synagogue, it could happen at a movie theater. What do you do with the randomness? How do you help children understand that? And also, how do you help them not feel anxiety about this? Because I can tell you, as adults, I feel anxiety about it, right?
Yeah, I think that what you just said is exactly it, right? This is not something that happens every day. As a country, we tune into this extraordinary gun violence. We don't tune into everyday ordinary gun violence, unfortunately. We privilege gun violence when it is huge and when it happens in a movie theater, in a synagogue, in a supermarket. And I think we need to amp down a little bit of the rhetoric around that. It is so scary, and it is also so statistically small that it's going to happen to our children. And I think we need to really help them understand that, that it is scary, and also we're doing everything that we can to keep them safe. I don't think we can promise them you're always going to be safe, because unfortunately that's not the case in 2018 in America.
And that's a new reality. I mean, how is there a specific approach that parents should be thinking about? I was thinking about this segment. There's a friend of mine who had a very extensive script for how he was going to think about talking to his children. What approaches do you think work best?
I think giving children the facts about what happened is really important. I think kids are going to hear the facts anyway. Kids are going to hear about what went on in school, in their classrooms, on the playground, on the bus, in the lunchroom, in the locker room.
It's ubiquitous today. We can't get away from it.
They're going to hear about what went on. So I think we, as parents, we really need to talk to our kids about what's going on. We need to give them the facts. We need to give them space to ask questions. We need to try to focus on, for kids, especially kids that are nervous about this, a plan. How do we stay safe? We stay safe by knowing our surroundings. We stay safe by going to an adult if we're nervous about something, by if we see something, say something. I think we also can empower children and students by giving back.
In other words, having them contribute back to communities that have lost something.
Absolutely. And so that doesn't keep them safe, but it does give them a sense of empowerment. So something bad has happened, something scary has happened, and now I am becoming a helper in X way. And especially for younger children, I think that's really empowering. It gives them an action.
Yeah, it sounds like the Mr. Rogers thing, always look for the helpers.
Always look for the helpers.
I still take that advice. Jennifer Rich is an assistant professor and the director of research and education at the Rowan Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. You can join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page or follow us on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway. And you can also connect with me. I'm at Tanzina Vega. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.